And if you're alone, if you are angry, if your heart is cold as stone, if you have fallen, and if you are weak, then come find the worth of God that only the suffering seek. Come lift up your sorrows and offer your pain, and come make a sacrifice of all your shame there in your wilderness. He's waiting for you to worship him with your wounds, for he's wounded too. He has not stuttered, and he has not lied when he said, "Come unto me. You're not disqualified. If you're heavy laden, you may want to depart. But those who know sorrow, they're closest to his heart. Come lift up your sorrows. Come lift up your sorrows and offer your pain. And offer your pain. Come make a sacrifice. And come make a sacrifice of all your shame, of all your shame there in your wilderness. He's waiting for you. He's waiting for you to worship him with your wounds, to worship him with your wounds, for he's wounded too. In this most holy place, he's made a sacred space for those who will enter in and trust to cry out to him. And you'll find no curtain there, no reason left for fear. And there's perfect freedom here to weep every unwept tear. Come lift up your sorrows and offer your pain. And offer your pain. Come make a sacrifice. And come make a sacrifice of all your shame, of all your shame there in your wilderness. He's waiting for you. He's waiting for you to worship him with your wounds, to worship him with your wounds, for he's wounded. Thank you. I especially start with that particular song because frequently there are people who come who are really wounded, and this is not a good day for you. Or perhaps you, the bad diagnosis, the relationship that's not going so well. And I want you to know that if you're in that place right now, you're in the right place. You've come to the right place. Sometimes in the church, we make people feel like they need to leave their problems at the door. Well, no, we want you to bring your problems right in here so we can help you bear them and help you take them to the Lord and offer them as a sacrifice. That's what we do with our confusion and our anger. We offered up David in Psalm 51, says, it's not the blood of bulls and goats you want. The offerings of God are broken spirit and a contrite heart. So if you have a broken spirit, you're in the right place. And welcome. You're with a group of brothers and sisters who know about brokenness. And I'm glad to be here. It's awfully hard for people to keep saying you're humble. Mother Teresa said you learn humility by being humiliated. I resonate with that. So the truth is I'm not that humble, actually. I'm an affirmation junkie. But we have a couple of days here to look at the Gospels, to look at the life of Jesus. I know all of the theological things about Jesus. I know, his part in the Trinity and his sacrificial death for us on the cross. I know about all those things, and I believe all those things. I'll take a bullet for those things. But I just find Jesus to be an endlessly fascinating person. He never does what you think he's going to do. I take very seriously his perfection. The Gospels are the only story we have of a perfect individual. Everything he said was perfect. And if he didn't say something, it was the perfect time not to say something. I take his perfection seriously and his life seriously. There are aspects of the gospel that we're going to look at that I hope are going to be new to you. People being afraid of Jesus. Every now and then, he actually made people afraid. His authority was so incredible. Sometimes, in fact, frequently, we see him hiding. That was never my part of thinking about Jesus. We're going to look at his radical demands. When Jesus says, follow me, that's not an invitation. That's a command, right? When he says to Matthew, follow me, it's not like, okay, go home, talk to your wife, see if this is a good idea, get back to me later. This explains why when he calls the 12, they drop everything and come, because it's a command. So I want to look at things like that. A lot of things that you already know that I hope that we can put in a new context, a biblical context. We're going to look at the life of Jesus, the Judaism of his day, because that's a big piece of the picture that we often don't look at. And so what I want to do first off is talk about how we engage with the Bible, because I think this is important. We all believe in the fall, right? We all follow. I mean, if you're married, you certainly believe in the fall. Boy, is my wife fallen. Whew. Never believed in the fall until I got married. I'm teasing, of course. So we take the fall seriously, and the implications of the fall we take seriously, right? We are broken, right? We're broken, hopelessly broken. In fact, we are so broken that we can't be fixed. You can't fix your spouse. You can't fix your children. You can't fix yourself. That's why you have to be redeemed. Right? It's not about being a better person. I can be a better person, for the next 1,000 years, and it's never going to be good enough. And isn't it wonderful that our God comes into our situation and gives us his spirit to start redeeming us, this process of making him more like himself? What an amazing thing that is. So one of the things I'd like to unburden you of, if that's a burden for you, is this idea that you have to be good for God to love you. You don't have to be good. You could be the biggest sinner in all Manila. He's not going to love you any less. You don't have to be, if you're writing anything down, write this down. You don't have to be good for God to love you. He loves you so you can be good. Right? While we were still sinners, He loves us and dies for us so that we can be good. So there's just some basic ideas that I'm very excited about. But we are fallen. We are fragmented and foolish and fallen people. So what does that have to do with studying the Bible? It has a lot to do with studying the Bible. Because even in the way we study the Bible, we're broken, we're fragmented. And this is how you see it. Some people come to the Bible with their brains. And that's a good thing. God gave you a brain, 256 billion gigabytes in memory. Did you know? That's the memory capacity of the human brain. They've calculated 256 billion gigabytes. Pretty good. God gave you a brain, and He wants you to love Him with your mind. But we're fragmented. And some people just read the Bible with their brain. You know these people. They like to argue, right? And they like to be right. They think that that faith in Jesus is all about being right, and that people who aren't right are going to heaven, only people that are right. But that's not what the book of Job tells us, is it? The book of Job tells us it's not about being right, it's about being faithful. Okay, so some people engage with their brains. That's not bad, but it's incomplete. Some people, my best friend is this way, some people engage with their hearts, and God gave you a heart and emotions, right? And they read devotional books. They like chill bumps. I like chill bumps. But that's a fragmented way to read the Bible for just devotion. What you have to do is find a way to bring all of yourself. In Deuteronomy 6, the great central creed of Judaism, if you're an Orthodox Jew, you pray this three times a day. Shema Israel, Adonai Eloheinu, Adonai Echad. Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one. The great creed of monotheism. But the next verse of that creed goes on to say, and you must love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, and spirit. That is, with everything you are. So verse 3, listen. Shema, listen. Verse 4, love. If you're writing anything down, write this down. The best way to show someone you love them is to listen to them. That's what the Shema teaches us. It's not to do something for them. Right? If you want to show your wives how much you love her, stop doing things for her and sit down and listen to her. Because the best way to show someone you love them is to listen to them. Ladies, you want to show your husband how much you love him? Stop doing things for him. He's not going to like it, but stop doing things for him and listen to him. You want to really show your children how much you love them? Stop buying them things and listen to them. Listen to them. You really want to show God how much you love him? Stop doing things for him and listen to him. Isn't that how he shows us he loves us? Doesn't he listen to us and our prayers endlessly? So I believe the best way to show God you love him is to listen to him. And the best way to bring all of my heart and all of my mind into the process of listening is to use my imagination. That's where imagination comes in. I believe your imagination is the bridge between your heart and your mind. It's what brings us together. And I believe this because this is what the Bible is targeting. The Bible is not theology, right? It's not didactic teaching. Jesus doesn't say, here's point one, here's point two, right? Write this down, Peter. This is going to be on test later. That's not how Jesus teaches. How does he teach? He steps up with no introduction and no explanation and says, a man was going down a road and he fell into the hands of men of violence who beat him and left him for dead. So he tells the story. And then at the end of the story, not every time, but frequently he will say, he who has ears to hear, let him hear. That's Jesus' way of saying, if you don't listen to this, you're not going to get it. You've got to engage. If you have ears to hear, you've got to engage. It's the greatest strength of Jesus' teaching, and it's the greatest weakness of his teaching, because not everyone's willing to engage. But he's not going to spoon feed. He's engaging your imagination. And the whole Bible is this way. I mean, the Torah, you know, the Genesis, it's stories. It's narratives about these remarkable, messed up people like Abraham and David and all those characters. And we get to the wisdom writings. You know, it's songs and poetry, right? That engages your imagination. Then we get to the prophets, and it's all incredible imagery to engage your imagination, your heart and your mind, right? Your heart and your mind. The life of Jesus, I mean, he comes, He engages us with his parables and with his life. His life is really a parable, and we'll look at that in the Gospel of John. Did you know there's not a single parable in the life in the Gospel of John? That should bother you. That should bother you. I'm going to say a lot of things to bother you. It's one of my favorite things. It's something I learned from Jesus. So we listen to God. We love God by listening to him, and we engage with our imaginations. What does that mean? What that means is we take the facts that we know, and we stop and we ask, what do they mean? What does this mean? What does it mean that Luke is a doctor? What does it mean that Jesus was from a place like Galilee? What does that mean? And we do our homework. We engage with Scripture at the level of the informed imagination. The man who mentored me was a man named William Lane. I wouldn't be here if it wasn't for Bill Lane. That was Bill's motto. We engage with Scripture at the level of the informed imagination. Have you ever been in a Sunday school class where everyone sort of imagines things without doing their homework, and it just kind of gets dumber and dumber, you know, more and more off the point? No, we got to do our homework. Let's find out what Galilee was like, and that's what I want to do for you, because that's my favorite thing. Let's find out what Judaism was like, what the Romans were like. Who's John? Who's Luke? Who's Mark? Who are these people, right? Because it's a fascinating story. So that's what we're going to do, if that's okay with you, because that's all I'm good for. So let's talk about, we're going to focus on John, but let's talk quickly about Mark and Matthew and Luke, who they are, and a little bit of their uniqueness, okay? Is everybody okay? Am I talking too fast? Awesome, okay. Matthew, Mark, and Luke are, you know what they're called? The Synoptics, the with one eye gospel, synoptic. And that's because they have largely the same outline. And if you're like me, I knew this. I heard this in church just like you did. And I sort of thought, well, I guess they're all the same. Matthew, Mark, and Luke, kind of the same. Well, they're not. Three completely different writers, three completely different life situations. Yes, they do share the same outline. Did you know that all of Mark is in the book of Matthew, except for 44 verses? The whole Gospel of Mark is in Matthew, except for 44 verses. He cuts out. Matthew, Mark, and Luke are three very different individuals. And let me talk about them really quickly, okay? Let me start with Matthew, because that's my least favorite gospel. We know virtually nothing about Matthew. Most of what we know about Matthew, we learn in chapter 9 of his gospel, and we find out he was a tax collector. Okay. We know his name's not Matthew. What's his name? Levi. Right, Levi. I think Matthew is the name Jesus gave him. That's just my opinion. I won't take a bullet for it. But I think Jesus had nicknames for all of his disciples. We don't know all of them. We know that he called Simon Peter, right? James and John, he called them Boanerges. There was one of his disciples he nicknamed Didymus, means twin. I think Matthew is a nickname that Jesus gave to Levi. Levi is a very Jewish name, isn't it? Who's Levi? He's the great priest. But Matthew is the worst Jew that Jesus has on his team, right? Tax collectors were traitors to their own people. They were listed with murderers, right alongside murderers, and all these other kind of sinners were tax collectors. And that's who Matthew is. But one of the problems is that Matthew is the most Jewish of all the Gospels, right? We know this, right? It's the most Jewish of all the Gospels. In fact, some people believe a scribe actually wrote Matthew. So that's a problem. We got to deal with that problem. What we do know about Matthew outside of the Bible, from church history, from a person named Eusebius. Eusebius was the first collector of histories of the church, and they're little fragments. It's a very interesting book to read. Some of it is just wacky, and some of it's really good. And the parts that I agree with, right, that agree with my theories, obviously I think are really good. The parts that disagree with my theories I think are wacky. That's how scholarship works. But at one point, Eusebius quotes a person named Papias from about 130 A.D. who says that Matthew collected the sayings of Jesus. Okay? That's the earliest statement outside the Bible we have about the Gospel of Matthew. Matthew collected the logia, the sayings of Jesus. Okay, now that makes sense to me. Matthew's a tax collector, right? Keeps records. He's good at that. He's following Jesus, and he's writing down what Jesus says. That makes perfect sense to me. And then when I look in the Gospel of Matthew, what do I find? I find five big blocks of the sayings of Jesus. If you get your red letter Bible out and look, there's, you know, pages and pages. One interesting thing I did years ago is I timed myself reading the red letters. So how much face time do I get with Jesus? Gospel of Mark, I get 22 minutes. When Jesus is speaking in Mark, you better listen, because he's not going to talk much. He talks almost two hours in Matthew, because there are five big blocks of the sayings of Jesus in Matthew. So that makes perfect sense. The rest of Matthew has been woven together with very Jewish themes. The kingdom is a big point for Matthew, right? Fulfillment. Everything is a fulfillment. Jesus moves to Nazareth, and Matthew quotes a Bible verse. You know, he'll be called a Nazarene. Okay. Everything has to be justified in his mind in terms of the Old Testament. So that's one of the fascinating things of Matthew. The thing we do know about Matthew is we know about the life situation of Matthew, and that's what interests me. We think Matthew was written right around 70 A.D. Something very big happened in 70 A.D. You know what happened? The destruction of Jerusalem, right? The Romans surround the city, and Jerusalem is leveled to the ground. Matthew was written right around that time, and right around that time in Judaism, Judaism was going from being many things to being one thing. Here's a big sidebar, okay? It's a big sidebar. The Judaism of Jesus' day is broken. This is very important to get the Gospels. And if you think about it, you know this. You know these things already. When we read of the life of Jesus, we got Sadducees, we got Pharisees, we got seven different kinds of Pharisees. They divided themselves into seven different groups. We got Levites and priests. We have Essenes, right? The holy men that are living out in the desert waiting for the Messiah to come back. And then all of a sudden, oh, and we have zealots, and we have zealot terrorists called the Sicarii, the knife men, all these mixed up groups. Then we have John the Baptist comes on the scene, and nobody in Jesus' day, no one agrees about anything. Judaism is not one thing, it's lots of things. And so when Jesus comes in, his ministry comes in, he's coming into this very fragmented world. And you need to know this. This is very important. The destruction of Jerusalem, when the Romans had surrounded the city of Jerusalem, 1 million people died. You know what most of the casualties were? Most of the casualties were the Jews killing each other. They were fighting each other. You read about this in Josephus. Josephus actually witnessed. He was standing outside the walls of Jerusalem. He saw Jerusalem fall. In fact, he stood out the walls and begged for the Jewish people to give up. He says, you have no idea how powerful these Romans are. He had seen how quickly Rome was rebuilt after the fire in Rome. He saw the resources that they had, and he told his Jewish friends, please give up. These guys are going to win. And they did win. But what you need to know is the Jews were killing each other inside. And when the Romans broke through, that stopped. Of course, the Romans killed a bunch of people too. Don't get me wrong. The Romans are bad guys. But Judaism in Jesus' day is broken. No one agrees on anything. No one agrees on the canon. That is, no one agrees on what books belong in the Bible. Right? And you know this from your New Testament, right? The Sadducees, they just accept the five books of Moses, right? The Pharisees, they accept Moses and the prophets. They like the prophets. Nobody knows what to do with the wisdom writings. Job, Proverbs, Psalms, Ecclesiastes, Song of Solomon. Nobody knows what to do with those things. No one agrees on resurrection, right? We know that, don't we? When Paul wants to start a fight, does he bring up Jesus
No. When Paul wants to start a fight, he says, you know why I'm here? You know why they arrested me? Because I believe in the resurrection, and there's this big fight. No one agrees on the resurrection. No one agrees on angels. No one agrees on heaven and hell. No one agrees on the canon. No one agrees on baptism. We see people arguing about John the Baptist, right? They're standing on the shore arguing about ritual cleansing because John is baptizing Jewish people, and you don't baptize Jewish people. You baptize Gentiles. So the point is, it's a very confusing, swirling world that Jesus comes into. And so when we get to the Gospel of John and we see someone like Nicodemus coming to Jesus, what you've got to realize is Nicodemus represents a broken Judaism. It's broken. It's broken, okay? So we go back to Matthew. At some point, Judaism becomes one thing, and that's after 70 A.D. That's why that's such an important date. If I used to hear my professors talk about 70 A.D. all the time, and I got so bored, so what? Oh, yeah, the Romans destroyed Jerusalem, so what? No, 70 is huge because after 70 A.D., Judaism became one thing. The Judaism that we know today is one thing. Very important, because here's what happened. After the Romans destroyed Jerusalem, if you're a priest or a Sadducee and you've got no more temple, you're done, right? If your job is to work at one place, right? Judaism, only you can only make sacrifices in one place. That place is gone, okay? You're a priest or a Levite or a Sadducee, okay, you're done. Essenes, the Romans basically crucified all of the Essenes. They wiped them out, so they're gone. The only party that's left standing is the Pharisees. That's all that's left. Two Pharisees come out of the destroyed Jerusalem. Two Pharisees, we know their names, came out. Oh, one of them was Josephus. We all know about Josephus. Very important person if you don't know about Josephus. An interesting character, character. There's a new book about Josephus that I'll recommend to you. It's called Jerusalem's Traitor. Jerusalem's Traitor. It's written by a man named Desmond Stewart. It's really good. It's on audiobook if you want to. I listen to it at night. When I'm a geek. I'm a Bible geek. I listen to books like that when I fall asleep at night. I listen to Josephus at night on my iPod falling to sleep. Don't be like me. Don't do that. So Josephus comes out of the destroyed Jerusalem, and another person whose name you may not know, a rabbi named Yohanan ben Zakkai. Yohanan John, the son of Zakkai. Yohanan ben Zakkai. Josephus and Yohanan ben Zakkai, they come out of the destroyed Jerusalem, come to their Pharisees. They come to the Romans, and they say, you have nothing to fear from us. Okay, we're on your side. You have nothing to fear from us. And the Romans embrace Josephus, right? He's kind of becomes Vespasian and Titus. You know, he's buddies with them. Yohanan ben Zakkai, the Romans say, okay, you can't go back to Jerusalem, but we'll give you a city. And the city is Yavne, J-A-V-N-E-H, Yavne. You may not have heard that word. Very important place, because that is where Judaism is reformed. It becomes one thing. So the Pharisees, only group left standing, the Pharisees get together in the city called Yavne, and they reform Judaism, okay? And what are you going to do? That's their dilemma. We got no more temple, right? What are we going to do? Hosea 6:6. It's a verse that Jesus yells at the Pharisees twice in Matthew, only in Matthew. Jesus says, go find out what this means. I desire mercy and not sacrifice, because we can't sacrifice anymore. And that word for mercy is a very important word. It's the word hesed. Hesed. Untranslatable Hebrew word. King James had to make up the word loving kindness. No translation. And then King James uses 14 other words to try to translate this untranslatable word. My translation takes a sentence. Hesed is when the person from whom I have a right to expect nothing gives me everything. And that's what Judaism is based on. Have you ever heard of a Hasidic Jew? That's a person who does hesed. It's the Hebrew word for saint. Okay? I desire mercy and not sacrifice. So Judaism becomes acts of mercy. That's what it's all about. That happens at Yavneh with Yohanan ben Zakkai. And you're saying, okay, so what? That's the world that Matthew writes into. Judaism is becoming one thing. And one of the things they have to do is get rid of the Christians. Get rid of the Christians, right? Because if it's going to be one thing, we can't have Christians. We can't have a group over here saying, oh, we found the Messiah. And until that time, Matthew's readers, they're Christians who don't know they're Christians, frankly. They probably have never even heard the word Christian, right? That comes later. They are Jews who have found the Messiah. They still go to synagogue. They still keep the hours of prayer, right? Paul and Peter, they go to the temple, right? They're faithful Jews who found the Messiah. But what happens around 70 AD is Judaism is becoming one thing, and we got to get rid of the Christians. And we get rid of the Christians by pronouncing a curse on them as part of our synagogue service. The 18 benedictions, if you ever heard of the 18 benedictions, that's the foundation for synagogue worship, the Shemona Israel, it's called, the 18 benedictions, 18 blessings. And I can read a couple of them if you're interested. Well, I'm going to read them even if you're not interested. You can't believe all the stuff I'm skipping. I'm skipping lots of stuff. Here's benediction one. If I'm an Orthodox Jewish person, I pray this every day. Okay, and when I go to synagogue on Saturday, we all recite this together. Here's number one, blessing. O Lord, open my lips, and my mouth shall declare your praise. Blessed art thou, O Lord our God, and God of our fathers, God of Abraham, God of Isaac, God of Jacob, the great, mighty, and revered God, the most high God, who bestows loving kindness, hesed, who bestows hesed, and the master of all things, who remembers the pious deeds of the patriarchs, and in love will bring a redeemer to their children's children for your name's sake. That's a pretty, you could read that in church, couldn't you? That'd be a great blessing to read. We can read that in church. That's blessing number one. I've got a bunch of them here. We don't have time to read them. Let me read blessing number 12. That's the problem. And for Nazarenes, let there be no hope. And let all wickedness perish as in a moment. Let all of your enemies, and that's the word menim, which means heretic. Let all the heretics, who's that? That's us. Let all the heretics be speedily cut off, and the dominion of arrogance uprooted and crushed, cast down and humble speedily in our days. Blessed art thou, O Lord, who breaks the enemies and humbles the arrogant. Okay. You're in Matthew's community. You're going to the synagogue. You found the Messiah. And someone says, okay, here's our new synagogue service. Take special attention to number 12. It's a curse on the Christian. So here's basically what happens. In Matthew's world, his friends and the family who are following Jesus are being kicked out of the synagogue. What happens if you get kicked out of the synagogue? If you're a Jewish person, you cease to exist. You have no identity. Have you ever heard the phrase, you're dead to me? That comes out of Judaism. You're dead to me. That means you don't exist anymore. And that's what you say to people who follow Jesus. That's the life situation of Matthew's readers. Okay? If you get this in your head and you go back and you read Matthew, it just comes to life. Because what is Matthew doing? He's telling you who you are because you don't know anymore. He's telling you who you are. Only Matthew says, we are the light of the world. And John, Jesus says he is, and he is. But in Matthew, Jesus tells us we're the light of the world. Only Matthew says we're the salt of the earth. And if you read those Jesus benedictions, his beatitudes, there's only 9 of them. It's all about the community, people who hunger and thirst for righteousness. So he's telling us who we are because we don't know anymore. And what's the major theme in Matthew? What's the major theme in Matthew? The kingdom, right? He's not interested in the kingdom because he's a good Jewish person. He's interested in telling them about the kingdom because he wants them to know they are part of a kingdom of which Jesus is the king. That's your identity. Of course, that's our identity, right? I mean, you're good citizens of this country. I hope I'm a good citizen of my country. But ultimately, we are members of a kingdom of which Jesus is the king. Okay? So Matthew's all about identity. If we had time, I could go chapter by chapter and show you how Matthew is constantly telling us who we are, but we don't have time to do that. So I'm going to leave that to you. Okay? Let me talk about Mark. Let me talk about a gospel I really like. Matthew. I'm skipping through notes here. This is so I don't leave stuff out. Oh, there's so much good stuff. We don't have time. But let's talk about Mark. Mark. We know a lot about Mark, don't we? We know a ton of stuff about Mark. He is a fascinating person. Let's talk a little bit about Mark. Mark's uncle was a person named Barnabas. Did you know that? That's Colossians 4:10. Who's Barnabas? Well, Barnabas is one of the early leaders in the church. Before Paul was even a Christian, Barnabas, and that wasn't even his name. His name was Joseph. Early Christians were taking nicknames too, right? Son of encouragement, that's what Barnabas means. John Stott says that Barnabas was the kind of person who believed in the work that God was doing in a person's life. Wouldn't that be a good thing to be said about you? He believed in the work that God was doing in a person's life. So when no one else believed in Paul, who believes in Paul? Barnabas does, right? All of the leaders of the church, they're afraid of Paul. Paul says, hey, I found Jesus. We go, yeah, right. You've been killing Christians. And only Barnabas says, no, I believe in this man. And so Barnabas takes Paul to the leaders of the church and represents him. When no one else believed in Paul, Barnabas believed in the work that God was doing in Paul's life. When no one else believed in Mark, his uncle Barnabas believed. You know that story. Paul and Barnabas had been traveling together, first missionary journey. And they take Mark with them. Mark is a young man. He's multilingual. He's a handy guy to have around. It's like if I got lost, I would want one of y'all, okay, because I'm not multilingual. I need someone who could speak all the different languages that are spoken in a place like this. That's Mark, okay? At one point in their missionary journey, they're going to go inland into the mountains of Perga. And Mark, who's a young man, for reasons we don't know, said, I'm done. I'm going home. I don't know if he got sick or if he was a mama's boy or something and he just wanted to get home. We don't know why. But we know when they got ready for their second missionary journey, Barnabas brings Mark and said, okay, let's go. And Paul says, uh-uh. He bugged out on us last time. And Barnabas believed so much in Mark that he and Paul split. From that time on, it's Paul and Silas. And it's Barnabas and Mark. Because Barnabas believed in the work that God was doing in man. Here's a great bet for you. Christians aren't supposed to bet, but here's a great bet for you. Go into any situation and ask somebody, who is responsible for half of the New Testament? And they'll go, Luke? Luke's responsible for like 26% of the New Testament. Nope, not Luke. Paul? Paul's responsible for 23%. Of the New Testament. Barnabas. If we didn't have Barnabas, we wouldn't have Paul or Mark. See, you'll always win that bet. Yeah. The other bet is, the other bet you'll always win is how many books are there in the Bible? You can win this bet every time, okay? Because if someone says, oh, there's 66, you say, no, Luke, Acts is one book. There are only 65. And if they say 65, you can say, no, everybody knows there's 66. So you can always win that bet. Okay. His mother is giving, we know about Mark, that his mother is giving leadership in a church that meets in Jerusalem. When Peter is busted out of prison by the angel, remember that in like Acts 13? Where does Peter go? He goes to Mark's house. That's the first time we ever hear Mark's name. Peter goes to Mark's house. Because Mark's mother is giving leadership in the church. Two of the writers of the Gospels' mothers were early followers of Jesus. Mark is one of them. John is the other one. Because Salome, who's John's mother, was one of the early followers of Jesus. Isn't that cool? Two of the writers of the Gospels were followers of Paul. Right? Luke and Mark. Their names appear in one sentence in the end of the book of Philemon. Mark and Luke, they hang out with Paul. So that's the other thing that's incredible about Mark. His cousin is Barnabas, right? He's an early follower of Jesus. I think the Lord's Supper happened at his house. I have absolutely no evidence, but I'm committed to the fact, you know, that that was it. The church starts in his house, right? And the most important thing you need to know about Mark is a disciple, a follower. Of course, they're all followers of Jesus, but Mark is a disciple, a companion of Peter. That's what you need to know about Mark. In 1 Peter, he refers to Mark as my son, okay? Some people think that indicates that Peter actually led Mark to the Lord. He was his spiritual father. How's that for a credential, right? Who led you to the Lord? Simon Peter. Church started in my house. Barnabas, he's my uncle. Yeah, pretty good credentials. And that's the guy that writes our first gospel. Now, that same person I quoted earlier, Eusebius, that church history guy, Eusebius tells us that at one point, the members of the early church, they came to Mark, who was a close follower of Peter, and they said, please ask Peter to write down the story of Jesus. Okay, please. Because one of the important things you need to understand about the New Testament is Paul's letters comes first. The Gospels don't come first. Chronologically, Paul's letters are written first. And Paul is dealing with problems in the church because the church is messed up. It kind of still is messed up, right? We go from having one perfect leader, Jesus, to having many very imperfect leaders. No offense, Pastor, but so that's the Paul period. But at the end of the Paul period, what's happening? The eyewitnesses are beginning to die. What does Luke say? Luke says, I'm not an eyewitness, but I talk to eyewitnesses. See, there's this period in the time of the history of the church. We got people who actually knew Jesus. Now, see the old guy over there? See the old bald guy? He knew him. Wow. We better talk to that guy, right? And that's what Mark does. Mark writes down the story of Peter. And when you're reading Mark's gospel, you got to understand that's Peter telling his story. If you read 2 Peter, Peter knows he's dying, right? He knows he's dying when he writes 2 Peter. And at one point in 2 Peter, he says, I've done everything possible to make it certain that after I'm gone, you'll be able to remember these things. Have you read that verse? A lot of us, I'm convinced that he's talking about the Gospel of Mark. See, he knows he's dying, right? I've done everything possible so that after I'm gone, you'll be able to remember these things. I think that's a hint that he's told his story to Mark. And Mark writes down the story of Peter. So the Gospel of Mark, in many ways, is really the Gospel of Peter. And it is it's amazing to read that story and look for Peter. For instance, Peter refers to the disciples as Peter and his companions in the Gospel of Mark. Peter always leaves good things about himself out. You read about the story about Jesus walking on the water. We read that in Matthew. Who else walks on the water? Peter. Read it in Mark. It's not there. Jesus walks on the water. There's no mention of Peter walking on the water. He leaves that out. Right at the end of the story of Jesus, Peter makes his great confession, right? They go to Caesarea Philippi, and Jesus says, who do people say I am? Blah, 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 whoever they say, other people say you are. But then he says, who do you say that I am? And Peter, who is really the spokesperson for the 12, they have a corporate identity in Peter. Peter says, you're the Messiah. Now, in Matthew, Jesus says, blessed are you, Peter. Baruch atah, blessed art thou. Because man hasn't showed that to you, God showed that to you. So you're speaking more than you know. So you're blessed. Okay, if you read it in Mark, the blessing's not there. Peter leaves the blessing out. But what is there is the curse. Because right after Jesus establishes that he's the Messiah, he has to explain to them what it means to be the Messiah. And what does it mean? It says that Jesus began to tell them that the Son of Man must suffer many things and be crucified. And Peter says, it'll never happen to you. Jesus, you don't understand. You don't understand. I know you may be the Messiah, but let me explain to you that the Messiah doesn't get killed by the Romans. I mean, the Messiah kills Romans. That's what the Messiah does. The Messiah doesn't get killed by the Romans. That makes no sense, right? And Jesus curses Peter. He turns the blessing into a curse. Get thee behind me, because you don't have in mind the things of God. You have in mind the things of men. He turns it upside down. The curse is in Matthew, but not the blessing. And you can go right through Matthew. You can see the influence of Peter. I'm convinced that one of the most important ideas in Peter's mind is this idea that you must believe before you see. In 1 Peter, he says, though you have not seen him, still you believe in him and are filled with an inexpressible joy, right? You know, I love that verse, okay? So you read the Gospel of Mark, and it's all about believing before you see. People who demand signs never believe them when they come. To demand a sign shows a precondition that you're not going to believe, right? Okay, who seeks a sign? A wicked and adulterous generation. That's what the Bible says. So, for instance, Peter has to make his confession that Jesus is the Messiah before the transfiguration. The transfiguration is proof, right? Jesus doesn't do proof. Peter has to confess that Jesus is the Messiah before the transfiguration. You must believe before you see. So that's the key elements of Mark. We don't have time to talk about it, but the other thing that makes Mark fascinating is the life situation. It was written right after the fire in Rome. It was written to a group of Christians who were suffering persecution under Nero, and we don't have time to look at that, but very, very interesting part of the story. I'm watching the clock. Okay, Peter. Let me read to you some of this is what Eusebius says about Peter and Mark, okay? This is in his book, The Apostles, book 2, number paragraph 14. Hot on the heels in the same reign of Claudius, a gracious providence brought to Rome the great and mighty Peter, chosen for his merits, a leader of the other apostle. I disagree with that. Peter was not chosen for his merits. None of us are, right? We have no merits. Like a noble captain of God, he proclaimed the gospel of light and the word that saves souls. Here, listen. Peter's hearers, not satisfied with a single hearing or with the unwritten teaching of the divine message, pleaded with Mark, whose gospel we have, to leave them a written summary of the teaching given them verbally, since he was a follower of Peter. That's about 250 AD. We get that. Okay. Here's Clement of Alexandria, 150. Here's an even earlier statement. When Peter preached the word publicly at Rome and declared the gospel by the Spirit, many who were present requested that Mark, who had been for a long time his follower and who remembered his sayings, should write down what had been proclaimed. Having composed the gospel, he gave it to those who'd requested it. Here's Papias, 130. We're getting even earlier. Papias says, Mark became Peter's interpreter and wrote down accurately, but not in order, all that he remembered of the things said and done by the Lord. So there's some evidence that Mark is the gospel of Peter. We don't have time to look at this stuff. I call Mark the emotional life of Jesus, because if you read how Mark presents Jesus, Jesus is very emotional in Mark. He gets madder. He's more compassionate. And that makes sense, because Peter sort of was close to Jesus and I think understood his emotional life. I have 15 passages, if we had time to look at, on the emotional life of Jesus. Matthew only refers to his emotions 6 times. Luke only refers to his emotions 7 times. And John only 4 times. So Jesus is very emotional in Mark, okay? There's so much. We just don't have time for all this. Let's talk about Luke, and then we'll take a break. Is everybody good?
Yes.
Okay. Let's talk about Luke. Luke is another person that we know a lot about, don't we? What do we know about Luke? Let me skip. This is all stuff that I could be... First of all, we know he was a companion of Paul, right? What does Paul say? Only Luke is with me, okay? Paul tells us that Luke is a doctor, okay? What would you expect? Well, my dad was a doctor. What would you expect of a doctor writing the story of Jesus? What would you expect? doctors, medical language, yeah. They use medical language when they don't need medical language. One of my favorite images growing up of my father, he was hanging a picture on the wall of our house, and to hammer the nail in the wall, he was using his reflex hammer, the hammer that he hit you on the knee with. It doesn't work very well. That's the only hammer my father had, okay? Doctors tend to be fairly focused. We want doctors to be focused, don't we, right? If I got this condition, I want to go to a doctor who spent his or her whole life on my condition, right? I want them to be focused. And Luke is focused that way. He uses medical language when he doesn't need it. He says in his introduction, I have carefully autopsied everything from the beginning. It's the word autopsy, yeah. When Zechariah, John the Baptist's father, asked for a tablet, he's going to write down his name is John. The word that Luke uses is the word for a prescription tablet that a doctor would use. That's like my dad using his hammer. That's the only word he knows. There are 700 words in Luke's writing that don't appear anyplace else in the New Testament. Imagine that. 700 words. So he is a bright dude. What I've tried to add to the discussion of Luke, years ago I wrote a book on slavery in the New Testament. I've sold literally tens of copies of this book. Literally tens, that's a joke. Literally tens of copies. It's a joke, not a very good one, obviously. But when I was studying the slavery in the New Testament, which is a very important concept, by the way, everyone's identity is a slave identity, right? Jesus, Philippians 2, 6 to 11, says he came in the form of a doulos, slave, not servant. Mary's identity, behold, she says, I'm the slave of the master. Paul, Peter, James, Jude, all sign off. I, Paul, a slave of Christ. The angel in Revelation that John falls down is going to worship. The angel says, look, I'm a slave just like you. Slavery is very important if you want to understand the New Testament. And so while I was studying slavery in the ancient world, reading the most boring stuff you could ever possibly imagine, it's so boring, I found out that in the first century, most doctors were slaves. How cool is that? You have to understand that a slave, I'm from the American South, and at one point, my culture was a slave culture, right before the Civil War. And one of the things that slavery does, one of the way it erodes your culture, is that it makes work a bad thing, right? The slaves do the work. So sometimes it's hard for us modern day people to think in this way, but in a slave culture, you don't aspire to be a doctor or a lawyer. You aspire to do nothing, right? If you're successful, you do nothing. In the South, where I'm from, we had a term. They were called the planter elite. What were they? They were white guys who were really rich who did nothing, right? The slaves do all the work. Okay, so Luke comes from that kind of a world. And so if you were a teacher or a first-rate doctor, you were probably a slave. The other cool thing is his name, he has a slave name. Luke is a slave name. There's two ways that you name slaves in the first century. One is you name them, of course, every time you buy a slave, you change their name. Okay, so every time you're bought or sold, you lose a little bit of your identity, okay, so you no longer exist as a person. You would name a slave by a quality that you hope they would demonstrate. So we meet a slave like Onesimus. Okay, what does Onesimus mean? Useful. That's a slave name, right? See, I buy this guy. Justin, I'm going to name you Onesimus because I hope you're going to be useful, right? You know the most popular slave name was Philokurios, master lover. Master lover. See, I hope you're going to love me, so I'm going to buy you. The other way that you name slaves, that you gave them nicknames of your own name. It's called hypocorism. That's your big word for the day. Why use a little word that everyone can understand when you can use a big word that nobody understands, right? Hypocorism, it just means nickname. So my name is Michael. God forbid if I were a slave owner in the first century, I would name my slave Mike. That's how it works, Mike. And listen to it, Luke, it's a nickname. It's a shortened form of the name Lucian. Okay, Paul has lots of companions who are slaves. Demas, that's a shortened form of Demetrius. So Demas is a slave. And Paul lists, he lists his slave workers, who he always refers to as his fellow workers. People that he works with that are free, he refers to them as slaves. Paul does that. So Demas was Demetrius, a short form of Demetrius. Luke is a shortened form of the name Lucian. And guess what? This makes the scholars' heads explode. Paul has a relative named Lucian. He refers to him twice. So I'm convinced that Paul's relative Lucian, and again, this is the only evidence I've got, but I think it's a really cool idea. I won't take a bullet for it. Paul's relative Lucian purchases a doctor because Paul has some sort of illness. We don't know what it was, right? He prays that God would take it away, and he doesn't. Lucian purchases a doctor worth 50 times more than an average slave because he's been to medical school, purchases him and gives him to Paul, and he becomes his companion, okay? I think it's a cool idea. But frequently the scholars' heads explode when I start building on my all my assumptions. I'm just a banjo player. It doesn't matter. I can get away with stuff like this. And the other thing we know about Luke is he's a Gentile. He's not Jewish. We know this because Paul meets him in Asia, Roman province of Asia, and we know that he's listed with a group of Paul's workers who are all Gentiles. So we believe that Luke is a Gentile. Okay, those are facts. Remember what I said? When you engage with your imagination, you got to stop and say, what does that mean? What does it mean that he was a slave? What would you expect from a slave? I mean, you can do this as well as I can. In fact, some of you can do this better than I can. What would you expect from a person who was a follower of Paul? This is interesting. In the Gospel of Luke, the Pharisees aren't bad guys. You ever notice that? Jesus has meal fellowship three times with Pharisees in Luke. Three times. Meal number one with Simon is very congenial. Simon, I have something to tell me. Tell me, Master. Nobody's calling anybody a brood of vipers or throwing anything like Jesus frequently does with the Pharisees. Meal number three is very congenial. Jesus is sitting, observing the Pharisees, watching where they sit, you know. No fighting, no name calling. Now, meal two doesn't go so well because the truth is Jesus had a problem with the Pharisees. They had problems with him. But what would you expect from a companion of Paul when he's presenting the Pharisees? Only in Luke do the Pharisees come to Jesus and say, look out, Herod's going to kill you. They're protecting Jesus. Who's Paul? He's a Pharisee. See? He's a Pharisee. Luke has been influenced by being around Paul. Paul is the apostle to the Gentiles, right? The Gospel of Luke is very interested in the fact that Jesus has come to the Gentiles, right? What does Simeon sing in the opening of Luke? That Jesus is a light to lighten the Gentiles. And you look all the way through Luke, and there's this heightened awareness of the Gentile mission. It's wonderful. What would you expect from a slave? And this is we'll stop with this on talking about Luke. What would you expect from a slave? When I was reading slave narratives, there's a rich literature from my part of the world, from the American South, that was written by African-American slave narratives, we call them. And if you can ever get a collection of slave narratives, they are fascinating to read. Well, one of the slave narratives tells a story. I'm from Tennessee, which is the long state, the most beautiful of all the states in the United States. The long, skinny one, that's me. Right above, right north of Tennessee is a state called Kentucky. And after the Civil War, there was a slave who had run away from his master and fought for the Union Army to free the slaves. And after the Civil War was over, he came back to Kentucky to see his old master. This is a white guy, right? So the slave rides up on his horse, the ex-slave rides up on his horse, and there's the master standing there next to a split rail fence. You know what split rail fence is? You take these split pieces of wood and you stack them and you make a fence. Okay. So the slave up on his horse, he looks down at the master and he said, hey, the bottom rail is on the top now. The bottom rail is on the top. What does that mean? Everything is upside down, right? You're standing on the ground. I'm sitting on the horse. I'm free. Okay, that describes a slave mentality. And that describes the Gospel of Luke. And once you see this, it will blow your mind. Luke is interested in the fact that the world has been turned upside down by Jesus. He's interested in the fact that people who should understand the gospel never do in Luke. And that people that shouldn't always do. So the bottom rail is on the top in Luke. And once I start mentioning these people, there are pairs of people all through Luke that does this. First pair, most interesting, Zechariah and Mary. Who is Zechariah? He is a priest, right? From a long line of priests, right? Where is Zechariah? He's in the holy place, right? Not in the Holy of Holies, which by this time is empty. Nothing in there. No Ark of the Covenant, no Shekinah, nothing. It's just an empty room. He's in the holy place. Who is he talking to? Gabriel. Okay. A priest in the temple talking to Gabriel. He should get it, don't you think? Does he get it? No. How can I be sure of this, he says. He ought not to have said that. Next scene, Mary. Mary's probably 15 years old, young woman. Women in Jesus' day were very marginalized, almost like slaves. Very marginalized in Jesus' day. The rabbi said, better that the law be burned than given to a woman. Does that make you feel good about yourselves, ladies? The Pharisees, there was a group of Pharisees, they were called the bruised and bleeding Pharisees. Every time they looked at a woman, they shut their eyes. They said, every time a man looks at a woman, he inherits Gehenna, hell. See, because the problem has to be with you. It can't be with me. I'm righteous, right? It's got to be your fault. So I'm going to shut my eyes. And they ran into things. They were called the bruised and bleeding Pharisees because they bumped into stuff. They called themselves that. They were proud of that. We are the bruised and bleeding Pharisees because you women, you are so evil, but we're righteous. Okay? That's the world Jesus grows up in. Okay? Samaritan woman, when the disciples come back from town, what does Luke say? Jesus, they're surprised to find Jesus talking to a Samaritan? No. They're surprised to find Jesus talking to a woman. Because men don't talk to women. We have other cultures like this in the world now, right? Where women walk 10 feet behind and they cover themselves up. There's the same mentality in the world today. Yeah. So here's Mary, 15 years old. She lives in Nazareth. Let me tell you, Nazareth is like the armpit of the Holy Land. We have no first century evidence that Nazareth ever existed. That's not because it didn't exist. There's no stone buildings. It's a bunch of wood huts. There are no diggings that show us anything from the first century. We go to Capernaum, and there's a huge, you know, synagogue and a bathhouse and a Roman, there's a huge city. Nazareth is no place. It's in Galilee. Galilee is no good. Jews from Galilee were very marginal. They ate meat and milk together. You're not supposed to do that. They go through Samaria, like we see Jesus going through Samaria. You're not supposed to do that. Jesus is a very marginal Jew in terms of Judean Judaism, Southern Judaism. So here's this woman, in a bad part of the world who shouldn't understand anything. And Gabriel gives her a much more unbelievable message, right? And what's she do? Immediately she gets it. Behold the slave of the master, she says. She identifies herself as a slave. See? Very important. How about Simon the Pharisee and the sinful woman? Okay. Simon the Pharisee, chapter 7. Who should get it? Right? Who knows his Bible better than all of us put together? Okay, Simon the Pharisee, he knows his Bible backwards. He should get this. Does he get it? No. He doesn't understand who Jesus is. Who gets it? The prostitute. She's the one who's weeping, and her tears are falling on Jesus' feet, and she's wiping his feet with her hair. See, once again, a religious man who should get it doesn't get it. And a woman intuitively understands who Jesus is and what he's all about. So look for that. Ladies, Luke should be your favorite gospel because he is very supportive of women. As am I, by the way. I'm your biggest fan. Okay. Yeah, that's the major theme. The Good Samaritan, right? Who gets it? The Samaritan gets it. Who doesn't get it? Priest and Levite. You can go right through. Parable of the prodigal son. Who gets it? The bad son gets it. The good son doesn't get it. It's all through Luke. The rich man and Lazarus. Okay, who sits on Abraham's lap in heaven? The leper. The rich man, who's blessed by God, where's he? He's in hell. You get, and this is Luke. The 10 lepers. Who comes back and says thank you? The Samaritan, right? The tax collector and the Pharisee. The rich young ruler and Zacchaeus. I mean, over and over and over it happens. And that's the Gospel of Luke. Okay? There's so much more that we could talk about. We just don't have time. Can we stop and take maybe like a, how long of a break do you need? 10? Okay. The boss says 10 minutes. Okay? So, 10-minute break. And we'll come back and I'll show you some pictures.